Bilingual Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter in Earl Stanley Gardner's The Case of the Careless Kitten, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to begin today's readings with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. In the last chapter, we learned that Helen had heard a thud in her Aunt Matilda's room, but she knew it couldn't have been her aunt because her aunt was in the hospital. Helen and her boyfriend, Jerry, ran up to the room only to be met by a gunshot, one of which seemed to wound the young man. And now we begin Chapter 12. Mason, getting into his own car, waved goodnight to Gerald Shore, watched the taillight on his client's car disappear, then started his own motor. "Phew," Delastreet exclaimed. "You certainly pick cases. If Lieutenant Tragg ever uncovers those facts, good night." Mason grinned. "There's only one way to keep him from uncovering those facts." "Oh, and what's that?" "Give him so many facts, other facts, in fact, to uncover, he won't have time to bother with these." "That will only hold him back for a while," she pointed out. "It's the best we can do, for now." Mason swung his car into Hollywood Boulevard, drove halfway to Los Angeles. "I guess the time has come to call in Paul Drake." Della sighed. "More overhead. What do you need a private detective for? Couldn't I do it?" "No, you could not." "Well, Paul's out anyway. He's taking this week off, and he swore that he wouldn't go to the office or take any job for love or money." "The devil, I'd forgotten." "You'll have to get one of his operatives. That sweet little guy who looks like a Bedlington Terrier is good. What's his name?" "He won't do," Mason said decidedly. "I need Paul." "He'll just hang up on you if you call him. You know Paul." "Yeah, I know Paul. I guess you're right. He just dusted me off." They cruised down the boulevard. "It is really important, isn't it, Perry?" "What? Getting Drake?" "Yes." Delastreet sighed resignedly. "All right, I'll pull up by the all-night lunch counter ahead, and if they've got a telephone booth, I'll see what I can do for you." "You? What makes you think you can get Paul out of bed in the middle of the night if I can't?" Della's eyes dropped demurely. "You just don't know how to appeal to Paul's higher instincts," she murmured. "I don't say I can make him work, but if I could get him down to the office, well, you might be able to handle him from then on." Perry Mason stopped in front of the lunch counter and followed Della in. She looked around, frowning. "Go ahead, do your stuff," Mason said. "I'll order us something to eat." Della shook her head. "This joint won't do." "Well, what's the matter? It looks clean enough." "There's no telephone booth." "There's a phone on the wall over there, stupid." "What I've got to say to Paul calls for a booth," Della drawled. "A wall telephone won't do. Come on, we'll have to try somewhere else." A few blocks further on, Mason stopped the car again in front of a brightly lighted diner. He looked in through the plate glass window at the interior, shining with chromium and glass, and locked the car. "We're eating here, whether there's a telephone booth or not. I'm hungry." Inside the door, Mason pointed to the telephone booth and headed for the counter. "Ham and eggs and coffee for me," she called after him. Mason said to the man behind the counter, "Two orders of ham and eggs. Keep the eggs straight up and fry them easy. Plenty of French fried potatoes, lots of hot coffee, and you might make up two cheeseburger sandwiches on the side." 5 minutes later, Delastreet joined Mason at the counter. "Get him?" Perry demanded. "Yeah, I got him." "Is he coming down to the office?" "He's coming down to the office in 30 minutes. "Swell. Say, what's the matter with your face? You haven't got a fever, have you?" "I'm blushing, you lug. I'll never do that again, even for you. I want my coffee now." "Well, I'll be damned," Perry Mason said softly. The man drew two steaming cups of fragrant golden brown coffee and slid them across the counter. "You'll like that," he said. "Best grade I can buy. I make it in small quantities and keep it fresh. They perched themselves on stools, placed elbows on the counter, sipped coffee, and watched the food cooking on the gas plate, the appetizing odor of frying ham swirling past their nostrils. "Now tell me why you need Paul Drake," Della said. Mason said, "I need a lot of facts dug out before Trag closes the case with a lot of half-truths." "Do you think Shore was telling you only half-truths?" Mason thoughtfully regarded the steaming surface of the coffee in his cup. "He was telling us the truth as he sees it, but he was seeing only part of the picture. There's nothing so deadly as a case built on circumstantial evidence composed of half-truth." The cook slid hot, thick platters across the counter. Generous slices of ham, the golden yellow of fried eggs, and the rich brown of French fried potatoes furnished a tempting visual background for the odors which came drifting up. "We eat," Mason said, "and do our thinking afterwards." "Your cheeseburgers are coming right along," the man promised, picking up the toasted buns, putting the fillings in them, spreading them thickly with white chopped onions. "Do you want mustard?" "Lots of it," Mason said. They ate silently, concentrating on their food. Della Street pushed her coffee cup across the counter for a refill. "Why did Matilda Shore try to keep Lieutenant Trag from knowing someone had poisoned her?" "Quite evidently, because there's some connection between that and the poisoned kitten." "Was it an attempt on her life?" "Looks that way." "Any ideas?" Della asked. "Well, it depends on the time element. Apparently, the stout was kept in an icebox." "What makes you think it was? Wouldn't go flat so quickly after it was opened and poisoned. Probably she keeps several bottles in an icebox." "How did the poisoner make certain she was going to take the poison drink if she keeps several bottles on hand?" "Probably by poisoning the nearest one, or perhaps by poisoning several." Mason shoved a $5 bill across the counter and looked at his wristwatch. The attendant at the lunch counter made change. "More coffee?" "Yes." "And a half a cup," Mason said. "That's all I have time for." He pushed back 25 cents out of the change, scooped the rest back into his pocket and said, "Mighty good grub. We'll be back again sometime." "In a hurry?" the attendant asked. "Uh-huh." He peered at them shrewdly through the upper part of his spectacles. "If anybody asked me," he'd say, "looks as though you two were headed for Yuma on a marrying party." "Nobody asked you," Della said, smiling. Mason took another 25-cent piece from his pocket, slipped it under the plate. "What's that for?" the man asked. "The idea," Mason said, grinning. "Come on, Della, let's go." They raced through the streets to the building where Mason had his office. Paul Drake Detective Agency was on the same floor as the lawyer's office, but nearer the elevator. Mason opened the lighted door, looked in on the man who ran the office at night. "The boss in yet?" "Hello, Mr. Mason." "No, he's taken this week off. I thought you knew." "If he should drop in, don't mention me," Mason grinned. "Just forget you saw me." They walked down the long, vacant corridor, their steps echoing hollowly against the walls. Dark doors on each side, lettered with the names of business firms, seemed like silent sentinels of dead businesses. The air in the hallway was musty and stale. Mason opened the door of his private office, switched on the lights. Della Street paused as he held the door open. "That's the elevator coming up again," she said. "I'll bet this is Paul Drake." Mason disappeared into the law library, closed the door. He could hear the steady rhythm of the approaching steps. "It's Paul, all right," Della said, whispered from the other side of the door. "Nothing ever seems to change the tempo of that walk. He's not stopping at his office." There was a soft knock on the door into the corridor. Della Street opened it a crack. Drake pushed it open the rest of the way, stalked in, slammed the door behind him. He looked at Della with slightly protruding eyes, which held no hint of an expression. Then he smiled sardonically. Tall, somewhat stooped, he had the manner of a professional undertaker making a midnight round of the mortuary. "Hello, kid," he said. "Hello, Paul." Della's voice was uncertain. "That's a good act. I didn't know you had it in you." He crossed swiftly to the door, concealing Perry Mason, and flung it open. "Come out of there, you cheap shyster. I'll teach you to try the game on me." Mason came out, grinning. "I had a hunch you didn't fall for it, but I didn't say anything." There was a wail from Della Street. "You played up and led me on and pretended you thought I was serious, and all the time you were laughing at me?" Shucks, Stella. I was admiring you. I wasn't laughing at you. His slow drawl was expressive, pungent. I just know you too well. Why did you come then? She demanded, pointing at him. Paul Drake's head drew in like a turtle's, then lunged forward and snapped at the tinted red fingernail a few inches away from his face. I figured Perry needed me, and I guess I've had enough vacation. I was bored stiff, he confessed, with his peculiar husky chuckle. Get this woman off my neck, Perry, and let's get to work. He squirmed his way into the favorite crossways position in the big, overstuffed leather chair. What's the excitement? For 10 minutes, Mason talked rapidly. Drake listened with his eyes closed. That's the picture, Mason wound up. Okay, so what do I do? Find out everything you can about Leech. Find out anything you can about all the members of the family, particularly what they've done since the hue and cry over Franklin's disappearance died down. Anything else? Yes. The man who telephoned Helen Kendall seems to have identified himself unmistakably as Franklin Shore. But in a case of this sort, you can't overlook the possibility of an imposter. Now, this man Leech has either been in contact with Franklin Shore or else trying to slip over a fast one. He's a number, Mason went on, opening up his notebook and tearing out a sheet of paper. Car license? Drake asked. No, it's a laundry mark. Laundry mark on a handkerchief that was tied around some personal stuff that seems to have belonged to Shore. It was on the seat of the car beside Leech. Leech evidently brought them along to show that he actually was acting as an intermediary for Shore. Why the intermediary? You got me. Maybe Shore didn't want to come back until he'd tossed his hat in the door first. Would it have been kicked out? Hard. Drake gave a low whistle. Like that, eh? Mason nodded. Trag knows you've got this laundry mark? Drake asked. I don't think so. I fumbled around and pretended to be interested in the watch. That laundry mark struck me as being peculiar. Paul, I haven't seen laundry marks inked on the hems of handkerchiefs for some time. Most laundries don't do it anymore. We should be able to trace Franklin Shore from that laundry mark. Anything else? That Castle Gate Hotel seems to be... I know that dump, Drake interrupted. Bunch of promoters hang out there. Slick stockmen, phony mining company stuff, get-rich-quick oil businesses, and that sort of thing. They don't promote their rackets from the hotel, but use the castle gate as a place to hibernate when things go sour. If they start hitting the jackpot, well, they move into a swanky hotel and an apartment and put up the dog. If the police don't get anything on them and the racket pays off, they move into a big-time situation. If the police do get something on them, they go to San Quentin. But when a racket doesn't pay off and the police haven't anything on them, they sneak back to the castle gate to make contacts with each other and lie low until the beef has passed. Okay, Mason said. Now here's another angle. Look back into the newspapers into 1932. You'll find they published a list of checks which had cleared through Franklin Shore's account within a few days of his disappearance. You can be sure police have dug up everything they could find out about the checks as of 1932. I want you to make a fresh investigation as of 1942. Anything else? Drake asked, jotting down notes in a leather-backed loose-leaf notebook. As an incidental development, a kitten was poisoned out at Matilda Shore's house. I think Trag will be covering all the drugstores looking for poison, and it won't be doing us any good for us to trail along behind the police. They have the organization and the authority. They'd be bound to get the facts before we could, but you might bear in mind the poison angle. What's the kitten got to do with it? Drake asked. I don't know, but Matilda Shore was fed poison from some source, apparently the same sort of poison that was used on the kitten. There's a chap by the name of Como who works as a houseboy. There's some question whether he's Japanese or Korean. Trag has a letter and a map, which was mailed special delivery around 6:30 from a Hollywood branch post office. It sounds very Japanesey, almost too Japanesey. However, you can't tell a thing by that. Como might have written it, or may have been someone who thought Como, because of his nationality, would make a good bait for the police to snap at. You can probably get a photostatic copy of the letter. Trag will be searching for typewriters which could have written it and will have had an expert check it over. You can probably find out from one of the newspaper boys what has been reported by this expert. The make and the model of the typewriter it was written on. It looked to me like a portable owned by someone who didn't do any serious typing, quite probably a man who's owned the machine for some time. What gave you that impression? Drake asked. Letters badly out of line, a faint ribbon which looked as though it had dried out from lack of use, dirt in the loops of the E's and A's, and a few strikeovers and crossouts, poor spacing of the letters on the sheet of paper, and irregularities in the letters which indicated a ragged touch. However, Trag will have seen all that most at a glance, so don't waste too much time on the letter. There's no use duplicating the police effort, and we can't expect to engage in competition with them on the things that they'll be covering. Okay, Drake said. Della Street said, the phone keeps ringing in the outer office. Hear that peculiar buzzing sound? That's the way the switchboard sounds when the lines are out and someone's ringing on the main line. It's been doing that at intervals for the past 5 minutes. Mason glanced at his watch. On a hunch, Della said, see who it is. She got up and went through to the outer office and in a few minutes came back, running. What is it? Mason asked. Helen Kendall. Someone broke into the house and shot her boyfriend, the one who's on leave from the army. She noticed the police and called for a taxi cab. She's at the hospital now. They're operating on a desperate chance. They don't expect him to live through the operation. She's been calling for the last 5 minutes. Mason nodded to Paul Drake. Let's go, Paul. Drake shook his head. You go. By the time you get there, Lieutenant Trag will have things sewed up so tight, you'll have to pay admission to get within a block of the place. I'll put in the time working with those angles while Trag's busy out there. Mason said, there may be something to that. This new department will keep him occupied, Drake said, and leave my hands free. Mason was struggling into his overcoat. Want to come, Della? Try holding me back. Drake looked at Mason and with his peculiar lopsided smile twisting his features. Where was your client when this last bit of shooting took place? He asked. Mason looked at his wristwatch, narrowed his eyes thoughtfully as he made a rapid mental calculation and said, that's one of the first things Lieutenant Trag is going to ask. For all I know, he's asking it right now and getting an answer. And as I figure out the time element, my client could have made it back to the house in time to do the shooting. Okay, so what's going on? Is there some kind of problem that Mason has overlooked? Or is there something about Gerald Shore that needs to be researched? We'll find out next time in The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. Our next readings come from the brochure called The Little Book of Donkeys. It's a limited edition Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue collection of stories featuring man's other best friend. The first story is about Casey. When a landowner near Wichita Falls, Texas, discovered Casey, his hooves were so overgrown that he could hardly walk. Sadly, years of neglect had left him in terrible pain. Even worse, his hooves had grown so badly that he could barely walk. Today he's safe at Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue, where our farrier team is helping him heal and start a new life. And that's a good thing. And then there's Floyd. Floyd apparently was beaten with a 2x4. There were men who did it over and over again. Three or four grown men would climb on Floyd's back, causing his legs to buckle under their weight. And at night, when they were drunk, they'd throw beer bottles at him, causing the glass to crash and shatter on the innocent donkey's face and body. It wasn't until Floyd's owners were arrested for drug possession and that the police were able to call Peaceful Valley Donkey Ranch to rescue the brave donkey. We drove 10 hours to get Floyd from the Oregon Veterinary Clinic, where authorities had taken him. When I asked the vet what treatment, vaccines, or tests he'd done, he looked at me in utter disdain and said, "What difference does it make? It's a donkey." but my heart truly broke when I saw Floyd in the holding area. People had betrayed him time and time again. Floyd had given up. His spirit was broken. It took just a few minutes to coax Floyd into our trailer. He seemed anxious to leave. Maybe it was the other donkeys we'd already had in the trailer. Maybe he was ready for a friend. Maybe nothing mattered to him anymore. It took a lot of love and care, but today Floyd has learned to trust and love his friends. None of this would have been possible without a friend he'd never known he had, and that was someone at the Peaceful Valley Donkey Ranch. And this is the story of Rawhide, roped for fun. Rawhide's owner used him as a roping agent. He was thrown, left body wounds around his neck and legs, and fear and distrust in his heart. When Peaceful Valley Donkey Ranch brought Rawhide from a local horse trader, the only information we had about his past came from his angry wounds and the terrified eyes. I spent weeks sitting quietly in the corner of Rawhide's pen, waiting for his story to unravel. The first time I tried to approach him, Rawhide shook so violently that he fell over. I understood, so I sat with my cup of coffee, paying for the sins of others, waiting for Rawhide to become comfortable with me being in his pen. It took days before I even stretched out my hand with a carrot in it, and as Rawhide tentatively stepped forward to take the carrot, his eyes begged me to understand. A few weeks later, he let me softly touch his forehead. This time his eyes admitted, every time anybody came near me, it hurt. And much later, when I'd been allowed to gently brush Rawhide's back, those same soft eyes told me they threw rocks at me when I brayed. It took a lot of love and care, but today Rawhide is happy, healthy, and finally has one thing he's ever wanted in life, people who love him and that he can love back. These stories about donkeys and their rescue is from the Little Book of Donkeys, a limited edition from Peaceful Valley Donkey Rescue Collection of Stories featuring man's other best friend. And now we move on to stories about cats. And this is about the cat tail and what you can tell about a cat from its tail. When your cat talks with her tail, take heed. While you should always look at a total body language and the immediate environment, your cat is in to get a full picture of what she's feeling. Here are some common emotions your cat could be trying to communicate simply with her tail. Straight up. A cat's tail often pops straight up when she's walking around in an environment where she feels confident. When she's approaching other cats with whom she has a friendly relationship, a straight tail is also a sign of trust and desire to engage. A wagging tail. Dogs wag their tails to show they're happy, but not cats. In fact, a cat's wagging tail usually means exactly the opposite. If two cats wag their tails at each other while their backs are arched and their heads are lowered, they may be about to engage in a skirmish. However, constantly wagging tails may also indicate your cat is in pain. If your cat is excited, marking his territory, is feeling stressed, anxious, or insecure, the tail will actually shiver or shudder. When the tail is straight and rigid, your cat is crouched and ready to pounce, and the tail is letting you know that it is at that point. And the tail is actually being used as balancing tool when making quick turns or jumping. If the tail is flicking or switching, a flicking tail or side-to-side switch indicates excitement, contemplation, beginning irritation, or that your cat is in pain. This could also mean your cat's focused, such as when he's watching a bird outside the window, and your cat's tail is flicking or swishing. But when a cat's tail is tucked, it could be a sign of fear or pain. When your cat wraps his tail around your legs or drags his tail over you, it's an affectionate, trusting gesture similar to humans holding hands or putting an arm around someone. Bonded cats will frequently walk with their tails entwined or will relax together that way. And if the hair on your cat's tail puffs out and his body arches, think Halloween cat silhouette, he's been startled by something and is really scared. Now, when the tail is lowered, that means the cat is unsure and is not quite certain what it should do. When the tail of the cat forms the shape of a question mark, it means he's happy or in a playful mood. It's also a way cats who are friends will commonly greet each other. And tapping. When your cat is in a relaxed position and tapping the end of his tail, it means he's slightly annoyed or contemplating something, like, I'm trying to sleep, and that sound you're making, it's bothering me. My tummy is grumbling, or I'm thinking about getting up to go to the litter box, but I'm so sleepy. All this information about cat tails comes from the special paw print edition, A Cat's Brain, How They Think, Learn, and Communicate. Well, we're coming to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.